Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Jay Wortman as my special expert guest. Dr. Wortman obtained his MD from the University of Calgary and completed family medicine residency at UBC. He has spent most of his career in public health. Early in the AIDS epidemic, Dr. Wortman was associate director of STD control at the BC Center for Disease Control, where he developed HIV testing and prevention programs. Since 1990, Dr. Wortman has worked at the First Nations and Inuit Health Branch of Health Canada in various senior management positions in Ottawa and Vancouver. On a research sabbatical at UBC, he studied the effect of a traditional-style diet on obesity and diabetes in an Aboriginal community. The study was the subject of the popular CBC documentary film, My Big Fat Diet. Dr. Wortman is currently the senior medical advisor for the First Nations and Inuit Health Branch, where he continues to study traditional Aboriginal and modern low-carbohydrate ketogenic diets. He is an assistant clinical professor at the Faculty of Medicine at UBC and lectures at the medical school there. Dr. Wortman serves on a number of boards and advisory committees. In 2003, he was the recipient of the National Aboriginal Achievement Award in Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Wortman. Welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning.
So it's always of great interest to everyone listening why someone such as yourself took up an interest in health and medicine. So how did it all begin?
At the beginning, actually, I worked for 10 years in construction in northern Alberta, where life was good, you know, as a young person ranging around working on the big petrochemical projects and making lots of money. And eventually I got to the point where I thought I could do something better with my life. You know, I was having a lot of fun. And I had some friends, you know, who had gone to university and gone into medicine, and I thought, hey, I could do that. So I was inspired and mentored by my friends and went back to school as a mature student and went into medical school.
When you went to medical school, did you find that pursuing the courses that you were forced to study, like some of the sciences, were challenging, or did you have a strong appetite for that?
I found it probably more challenging in the pre-med years when I did a science degree because it was very competitive and somewhat ruthless, and you had to take a lot of basic science courses, which were quite demanding. Once I got into medical school, in some ways it was easier. That competitiveness wasn't as intense, and the subject matter was more interesting, and you were more focused on what you were actually going to be doing eventually. The courses had more relevance.
Now, looking at your bio, you have a tremendous amount of experience in certain areas, for sure. Looking at Statistics Canada, we know that there's a couple of million diabetics in Canada. So why do you think that diabetes is on the rise, and why is this disease doing all of its damage to Canadians?
Well, my focus has been in the area of nutrition, diet change, and the epidemic of diabetes, and I've tended to look at it through the example of the Aboriginal population because they have experienced the greatest effects of the epidemic, and they've also had the biggest changes in diet in recent history. So I've come to the position where I think diet has played the largest role in what's happened. And when I look at the scientific literature on this, I think there's still some puzzles there in terms of what is actually the initiating problem here. And right now I'm looking closely at fructose. I think the case that excess consumption of fructose may be actually the triggering event in this dietary story is starting to, you know, that case is starting to take shape in my mind.
We're residents of Hawaii, and when we just left there recently, we found out like the pineapple's dying there, it's closed down on Maui, and the cane industry is dying. I guess, isn't it true that the corn industry is kind of out-muscling the cane industry for sucrose, and so fructose is becoming more prevalent everywhere on the planet?
Well, I mean, a big source of dietary fructose is from corn products, probably most famously high fructose corn syrup, which has, you know, it's subsidized. The corn production is highly subsidized in the U.S., and it's kind of muscled sugar out of the way. But the fact is that every sugar molecule is also 50% fructose. So I think it's become an issue of increasing quantity more than the relative quality of the different sources of fructose. And if you look at food consumption data or food availability data, consumption of what we would classify as caloric sweeteners, so anything that is naturally sweet, has increased dramatically and almost in parallel with the rising obesity epidemic and diabetes epidemic.
Why is it that when we travel around the world, we see the native peoples on each continent, and somehow, for whatever reason, they experience the worst possible outcomes as it relates to health and obesity, and they seem to really struggle with the so-called white man diet? So why is that? Why are they having such an extreme case of experience compared to everybody else?
That's a really good topic. You know, it deserves a lot of discussion. There, you know, a lot of people subscribe to the idea of the hunter-gatherer gene, you know, the gene that allows you to store energy more efficiently and so on and survive in times of deprivation, the so-called thrifty gene. I'm not sure that that's the case. If you look in general at these populations, and we're talking about native populations, usually in countries where there's been a lot of destruction of culture, and these people tend to live as marginalized minorities living in poverty and so on, a lot of the health problems can be accounted for by the poverty and these other destructive circumstances. The other thing to consider is that when you look at, for instance, metabolic syndrome, which is, think of it as pre-diabetes, the places in the world that have the leading rates of metabolic syndrome are actually the Arab countries in the Middle East. So people used to talk about vulnerable populations. What is emerging now is a picture where everybody's vulnerable and some people seem to have some inherent protection. And that's in those people are in the minority, and they generally tend to come from Central and Northern Europe.
So can you tell us exactly what diabetes is and what the difference is between type 1 and type 2?
Type 1 is the type of diabetes that will often affect very young children. It can happen into adulthood, but is primarily seen at a younger age. And it's an autoimmune disease where the body's ability to produce insulin is destroyed. Your immune system destroys the cells that produce insulin. And people that have type 1 diabetes must take insulin injections for the rest of their lives. Type 2 is usually in a slower onset. When I was trained, we were taught that you would tend to see it in adults, although we're seeing it in younger and younger people now. And the cause of that, it's thought to be diet and exercise, lifestyle-related cause. And the fundamental defect there is not a lack of insulin. It's the inability of insulin to allow sugar into cells. The cells have developed resistance to insulin. You've got insulin resistance, which ironically actually causes the pancreas to produce more insulin. So type 1 diabetics produce no insulin. Type 2 diabetics, certainly early in the stages of their diabetes, will have excess insulin in their system. And I've come to look at these both now through a different perspective. I tend to look at them as diseases that are actually food intolerances. Whether you have type 1 or type 2, you've lost your ability to normally metabolize carbohydrate foods. Your body can no longer normally process glucose. And whether you acquired it through an autoimmune effect or whether you acquired it through lifestyle factors, the end result is the same. You can no longer normally metabolize glucose. So I tend to look at it through that lens. And in that sense, they are similar.
Is there evidence that type 1 is increasing statistically?
Not that I'm aware of, no. There are immunological factors that predispose an individual to getting type 1. And there's nothing I can see out there that would cause those immunological factors to increase or multiply.
Now, I've had some heated discussions and debates with dietitians and even university professors who claim that there's no relationship at all between the consumption of any amount of refined sugar and carbohydrate and diabetes. What's your position on that?
Well, I think that's true of type 1, but I don't think that's true of type 2. I think the opposite, in fact. I think that it is largely the result of dietary consumption of probably fructose. Certainly, the pressure of diet high in refined carbs is a factor, but the evidence is pointing more and more towards the specific molecule of fructose.
So going back in time when people, we'd have to go back not too far, there's no refined food, no sugar, hunting, gathering. Do you think that the evidence of diabetes type 1 is still present and is equal to our current state?
I'm of the opinion that type 1 has been basically a background baseline level of type 1 that has probably not changed over the years. Type 2 is where the action is. That's where the big epidemic is and where we potentially have the ability to prevent it.
Right. So how would one know? Now, you talked about metabolic syndrome. What are some of the symptoms there, and how would we know we have it, and what are some of the common symptoms of diabetes?
It's looking more and more like this whole spectrum of problems, this spectrum of chronic disease, is linked together by insulin resistance. And the profound expression of insulin resistance is type 2 diabetes, where you've got insulin resistance and it's severe enough that you can no longer maintain a normal blood sugar. That's type 2 diabetes. Prior to that, we know there are other conditions associated with insulin resistance. And metabolic syndrome is defined by a collection of things. Excess weight around the middle, so abdominal obesity, is a defining part of metabolic syndrome. And then other things include high blood pressure, signs of blood sugar problems, not necessarily enough to mean you have diabetes, but evidence that you're starting to develop blood sugar problems, and dyslipidemia, cholesterol problems. Interestingly, in metabolic syndrome, there's no mention of LDL cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol, the one that's treated by statins. The dyslipidemia of metabolic syndrome is low HDL, low good cholesterol, and high triglycerides, which is free fat in the blood. These are common hallmarks of metabolic syndrome. And the constellation of metabolic syndrome, there's been a lot of debate over what exactly defines it, but that's pretty much the current definition, is it's recognized that all these things are risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So I tend to think of this as a spectrum that starts with obesity. You move into metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, and if you have type 2 diabetes, there's an 82% chance you're going to die of cardiovascular disease. So the whole thing seems to be one big disease continuum, the underpinning of which appears to be insulin resistance.
Now, Tracy and I met you by watching the CBC documentary film, My Big Fat Diet, and we were very impressed with you and your demeanor and the way you came across as an educator. And I think that the motive behind the experiment seems to be quite clear, this genuine sincerity intention there, wanting to help people, and that's what we like to do. Now, could you tell us about this research project and what you discovered by getting involved in the study?
Well, I work with the First Nations population in Canada, and they have terrible problems with obesity, metabolic syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. And I started to discover that carbohydrate-restricted diets delivered a lot of benefit to people with insulin resistance, problems related to insulin resistance, including type 2 diabetes. I saw people get right off their insulin and off their medications and lose weight and basically return to normal when they had type 2 diabetes simply by removing carbohydrates from their diet. And the other thing I observed was that the traditional diet in this part of the world, northwest coast of Canada, their traditional diet was very low in carbohydrates. So it occurred to me that perhaps we could encourage people to eat a diet similar to their traditional diet and see if that made them better. And so we were able to do an experiment. We went to a small First Nations community in a little place called Alert Bay off the coast of Vancouver Island, and we recruited people to eat a diet that was based on their traditional diet but allowed non-traditional foods that were low in starch and sugar. So it was a very low carbohydrate diet. And we followed them for 12 months and recorded things like weight loss and improvements in diabetes and metabolic syndrome. And we got very good results. Basically, it depended on how well they stuck to the diet. If they stuck to the diet, they lost a lot of weight, they got off their medications, their blood tests returned to normal, and they felt a lot better. It was a very rewarding project.
Yes, and of course this raises this issue of compliance and consistency, and in my field with exercise, you know, Tracy and I used to own a gym, and we understand that most people are not consistent in the application. They know they should do it. They know it's great when they do it. So with these people, I was interested, what direction did they head into? Like after you were there and supervising them, it's almost like the Biggest Loser. When the pressure's on and the support's there, it's great. They make these great results. But what happens when they're left to themselves and you're not there? What's the significance of your impact based on their ability to continue doing what needs to be done?
I don't have a precise answer to that, and I stay in touch with people there. My impression is that some people, once the study was over, they kind of said, okay, I'm going back to my old way of eating, and would suffer the consequences. They would relapse in terms of their metabolic problems, and some people have stuck with it. And I spoke to the doctor there recently, and he said that there's still a raised awareness about food and healthy food in the community, and that his impression was that there was a lasting effect, beneficial effect there of the diet. And I do talk to people there once in a while, and recently somebody was talking to me about rounding up another group of people and getting them back on the diet. So I think there was a recognition there that this was a good thing to do. But as you say, you know, it's like exercise. Some people find it easy to fall off the wagon and then hard to get back on.
Yeah, and the athletes that we work with, elite Olympic champions, they say that the diet is the hardest part, that it's so easy to fall off. The athletes that are totally committed to training, they never miss a beat. But when it comes to eating, they just struggle with, you know, staying away from the fast food, the junk food, the refined sugars and sweets, because there's so many people around them that are living and eating that way. Is that a big part of the problem?
I think the context, the environment, has a big influence on how people comply. It's like drinking, you know. If you're trying to quit drinking, it's not very good to be hanging out in the bar every night. And for people that are trying to cut these crappy foods out of their diet, we're swimming in it. Everywhere you go, people are pushing this stuff at you. So it's very hard. I find it particularly hard with kids. I have young kids, you know, and it's a terrible environment out there for sugar and all these refined foods.
Our three children are adults now, and we raised them on an organic whole food diet when they didn't have any ability to choose, like from 0 to 5.
Uh-huh.
And they expanded and went out into life, and then they all came back to it because they said, Dad and Mom, your way is a better way, because we feel better and we can see what our friends are doing is not moving them in the right direction. They're all getting sick, they got infections, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess we need to really come to terms with the reality of our experience and then equate the choices, and then ultimately it still resides within us to make the right choice.
Absolutely. Yep.
Now, I knew Robert Atkins, and I interviewed him once, and of course his diet was a big rage, and you know, the corporations took it over, and they promote a, you know, low carbohydrate. And he was onto some neat stuff, because he, like yourself, said that these people that are very obese just can't metabolize sugar. And I didn't agree with some of the foods that he allowed. So let's talk about the diet that you advocate. There's no refined carbs. You get away from the starches like the rice and the potatoes and bread, which obviously are staples. I know Lauren Cordain, and you probably know of him and his books, and he's promoting this as an anthropologist. So do you think that this dietary approach is really a doable thing for the average person, and that they can really look forward to some reliable outcomes when they take this approach?
I do. You know, I use myself as an experimental subject. I'm not a superhero. I'm just an ordinary person. I'm not a jock. I don't exercise as much as I should, you know, that sort of thing. And I've been able to maintain this diet for 8 years. So I think if I can do it, anybody can do it. And I think particularly for people that have developed problems associated with insulin resistance, and that's probably a big part of the obesity epidemic, as well as metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes. Anybody with a problem related to insulin resistance seems to derive enormous benefits from this type of diet, as opposed to, for instance, a low-fat, low-calorie diet. There have actually been studies now, some really quite well-done studies, that show that if you have insulin resistance, this is clearly the diet you should be on, that you may actually get worse on a low-fat, low-calorie diet that where the significant part of the calories is carbohydrate. What I generally tell people is think of this as a carbohydrate intolerance, like any other food intolerance, because that's a concept most people can understand. A lot of people are familiar with lactose intolerance, for instance. And we know that with lactose intolerance, the intolerance doesn't really go away, but as long as you don't eat lactose, you don't suffer the consequences. And that appears to be the case here. If you've developed insulin resistance, you have a carbohydrate intolerance, if you don't eat those foods, the problems associated with that tend to get better or go away. So there's a good body of scientific literature now. There have been a number of good studies that consistently show this. So I'm pretty comfortable recommending that to people with insulin resistance. And how it compares to the Atkins diet, it probably resembles the induction part of the Atkins diet, where the carbohydrate count is quite low. And the other thing that I've come to appreciate about that kind of a diet is that our concern about fats have been somewhat misplaced. We've been told to cut down on fat because they're high in calories and to avoid saturated fat because of risk of cardiovascular disease. But when you actually dig into the literature, look at the scientific evidence, these recommendations don't stand up to scrutiny. The evidence that dietary fat causes you to become fat, it's just not there. And some fairly good recent studies have shown that saturated fat is not actually the driver of cardiovascular disease that we thought it was. The kind of diet I recommend to people, in fact, what I recommend to people right now is, if you have any of these problems, get your hands on the most recent Atkins book. It was written by three of the researchers I collaborate with, and it's updated the Atkins diet with modern research findings, and it includes the research references, and I think that's probably the best diet right now out there for people with insulin resistance.
Great. Thank you for that recommendation. Now, looking back in the evolutionary scale of time, we know that this agricultural change has made a huge impact going back only, I guess, 10,000 years. So do you think at that time, you know, when the goat herders started drinking some milk, or they started, you know, like the Peruvians had their quinoa and some of these other non-traditional grains, were they so bad, or was it the fact that we've moved forward and because of agriculture and its connection to business and transport and profit, do you think that it's evolved into something that sort of started off as something okay but is really bad now?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, really. Agriculture probably began maybe even 15,000 years ago, but it's still a relatively short period of time in terms of the evolution of hominids. And it would appear that it had advantages, because it certainly, over time, displaced hunter-gathering modes of survival. But it also seems to have come at a price. And you're probably familiar with Jared Diamond's books, Collapse and Guns, Germs, and Steel. He published an interesting article in 1987 in Discover magazine. You can find it if you Google it. The title of the article was "The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race." And in this article, he discusses the paleopathological evidence that can be found in sites all around the world, where you find that people that went from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to an agrarian lifestyle suffered a decline in their health status. There was a reduction in height. There was evidence of deficiency diseases and chronic diseases and so on, things that you could find by looking at skeletons, which suggests to me that, yes, agriculture was very successful in basically dominating how food supplies were produced around the world, and probably was necessary to build up societies, stationary societies, population centers, and culture and technology as we know it, and military as we know it. But it came at a price, and I think the price is the tendency for chronic disease and poor health status.
No doubt. Now, what comes up that some people don't really have a good grasp of when you talk about ketones and ketogenic diets? And I know it as a bodybuilder, I'm a natural bodybuilder, and I go into a state of ketosis. Like, I have a strong interest in the Plains Indians and the consumption of buffalo as probably being the best example of sustainability ever, like beyond the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Greeks and the Romans. These First Nations people, and the ones on the West Coast, I think they had, you know, some salmon and fish. Mm-hmm. It seems to be something that proves itself out over time, that if you can keep doing it and you've done it for a long time, then, and the species isn't dying off, it must be very effective. So is going into a state of ketosis when you're eating natural foods a bad thing, or is it a bad thing when you're eating really terrible fats and the wrong kinds of foods?
Well, let me make a comment about the Plains Indians, because that's a fascinating culture. They lived on buffalo pretty much exclusively. They were migratory. They followed the buffalo. They would kill and eat fresh buffalo, but they would also process the buffalo and turn it into pemmican, which was a durable food that they could carry with them. Pemmican was about 80% buffalo fat and 20% protein. And they lived on a diet that was not unlike the diet of the Inuit, which was about 80% fat and 20% protein. And when the Plains Indians were first encountered by European observers, they were found to be between 6 and 7 feet tall. It was very rare to find anyone under 6 feet tall, any adult. And height is an indicator of overall nutritional health of a population, just like the Maasai warriors, who eat nothing but blood and flesh and milk, are quite a bit taller than the neighboring tribes that cultivate and eat plants. So it's a really interesting story of how people can thrive and be very robust and healthy on a diet that's devoid of carbohydrates. But getting back to your question of ketones, anybody who's not burning glucose as a primary fuel will be depending on ketones. And your body breaks down fat and converts it into the ketones, which are used as a fuel. That causes the presence of ketones in your blood, which is ketosis. That's what the word means. And we talk about physiological ketosis. And this is a normal state that you're in when your body's not burning glucose. And for a lot of people, they're in ketosis in the early hours of the morning when they're the last amount of glucose, the carbohydrate they ate, has been burned off from their dinner. And so it's nothing to be feared. And if you look carefully in the scientific literature, there's no evidence anywhere that physiological ketosis causes any harm. But there is a confusion about that, because ketoacidosis, which is an entirely different circumstance, is harmful. And that's where ketone levels are extraordinarily high. You have high blood sugar, you're dehydrated. This is a problem that can occur with type 1 diabetics. And I think a lot of people confuse ketoacidosis, which is harmful, with physiological ketosis, which is a normal, natural state of nutritional completeness in the absence of carbohydrates in your diet.
Dr. Werben, now isn't it true that carbohydrates are not truly physiologically essential, that man or humans can live without ever eating a carb, provided they get those essential fats and essential amino acids?
It's true, yeah. Of the three main macronutrients are protein, fat, and carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are not necessary. The other two are. And yes, you can live perfectly healthy without any carbohydrates in your diet. A lot of people at this point are thinking that we're crazy to say that, but it's true. If you actually look carefully at the nutritional science literature, it's quite true.
Well, based on that statement, and I agree with you for sure, because that's what the science seems to spell out, therefore, if carbohydrates are essential, that would also make fiber a non-essential substance as well. Not necessarily not beneficial, but not essential.
True. This is true. The whole thing around fiber is another one of these stories where there was a bit of a snowball effect. Somebody made some observations and developed a theory about it. It was Burkitt, actually, who worked in Africa.
Dennis Burkitt, yes. Yeah. A great person.
Yeah, he was one of the pioneers of medicine. Burkitt's lymphoma was named after him. But he observed that people eating a very high-fiber diet in Africa, where he was working, had no bowel disease. So he attributed that to their diet and promoted the idea of a high-fiber diet. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, the Maasai ate no fiber at all and also did not have bowel disease, and as did the Inuit. They had no fiber in their diet. They had no bowel disease either. So it wasn't the fiber, but that story gained momentum and developed a big mythology around it, which endures today, even in the face of, there have been some big meta-analysis. One of them was a Cochrane collaboration analysis that looked at the literature, the scientific literature on fiber in the diet, and the only enduring benefit with fiber appears to be the fact that if you're eating a lot of carbohydrates and you eat fibrous ones, the spike in your blood sugar is not going to be as dramatic, so that there is some benefit in that sense.
Right. Going through your website and you're reading your blog, you talk about some of the people out there that are critical of your work, and with the evidence that you have, and you know it must be an enormous amount, not just you, but the collectors of science and those who follow reason and logic, why would anyone take a shot at you or be critical of what you're promoting?
Oh boy, that's a really interesting dynamic, because the ideas I promote are orthogonal to the conventional approach, and the conventional approach has the center stage right now. Most people everywhere are supporting the conventional approach. It's hard to turn a big ship around. Just recently I was looking in Wikipedia and I looked at the biography of Ignaz Semmelweis.
Oh yes, the Hungarian.
He was a Hungarian doctor who discovered, he was working in Vienna in the maternity hospital, and he figured out that if you washed your hands, fewer of your patients died of infection. And his reward for discovering that and showing that it worked, when he was working in the wards, the infection, death from infection went way, way down. His reward for that was they literally drove him insane and he died in an insane asylum. So, you know, when the whole medical community has seized upon one approach, even when there's powerful evidence showing something completely different may be better, it takes a long time to turn that ship around.
So is that what we can look forward to, the same kind of outcome that Semmelweis experienced?
I prefer the outcome that Galileo suffered. He was banished to his villa in Tuscany for suggesting the Earth's orbit around the sun and not vice versa.
Which wasn't too bad of a lifestyle.
No, better than dying in a insane asylum, yeah.
Yeah, good point. That's great. Now, we're running out of time, and it's just been a fantastic interview. Thanks so much for the information. What's your feelings or thoughts about where we are and where we're going? What's the future of mankind to you in your mind? Do we have hope? Is there enough people out there that can turn things around, or, like you say, turn that big ship around for us? And enough people that are interested in doing that?
I think one of the problems is that the healthcare system is going to buckle under the weight, pardon the pun, but under the weight of all this chronic disease. It's going to be unsustainable. So ideas that might appear orthogonal now may actually gain traction when it's shown that they work better and are cheaper to implement than the current approaches. Right now, the polypharmacy approach is very expensive, and the outcomes aren't particularly good. People still develop complications and incur a lot of expensive medical resources because of the failure, essentially, of the current approach. So I think there's that factor, but I think there are other events that are probably going to overtake us. I think the things that are going on around us in terms of the economy and the dwindling fossil fuel supplies and the climate change, I think we're heading into all kinds of trouble, not just trouble with overeating a high-carb diet. So I think other events may actually overtake us. I heard an interesting definition of farming recently. It was defined as the use of land to convert petroleum into food. And I think therein lies one of the more immediate problems I think we're going to encounter, which may exacerbate the epidemic by making it harder to eat the high-quality fats and proteins that we should eat, and in the end may actually reduce the epidemic through starvation. So I have a somewhat optimistic and at the same time gloomy outlook.
Well, doesn't it still come down to what we do ourselves individually? The best that we can do for ourselves is to get as well and strong as possible in spite of people maybe not doing that or having any interest, so that we can at least cope with the stress of change coming at us?
Absolutely. That's your primary concern, I think, is to look after your own health and make sure you're raising your kids in a healthy environment.
Yeah, wow, thank you for that. So can you please share your website address with our students and members?
It's www.drjaywortman, and it's drjaywortman.com.
So we have time for one more comment. Anything that you'd like to leave us with, perhaps something philosophical or motivational?
Well, I always like to inject just a note of caution. When people listen to this and think, hey, you know, I've got diabetes and blood pressure problems, maybe I should stop eating carbohydrates, I would encourage you to do that, but you have to be very careful if you're on medication, because the diet is very powerful, and if you continue to take medications for blood pressure and blood sugar, you'll have a compound effect, and you may end up in trouble with blood pressure and blood sugar that's too low. So I just like to end with a word of caution to people. And if you're going to try it, I recommend the current Atkins book, the newest one. It's called The New Atkins for a New You, written by Drs. Westman, Finney, and Volek, who are all excellent scientists in this area.
Dr. Wortman is a medical doctor and a teacher. You can get to him on his website. He has worked with the First Nations people and has a lot of great information that I've seen and read. Dr. Wortman, we thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Representing lifestyle, new way of life. Listen, it's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.